Chapter 46. If I went into Kenj's office, said Richard, and if I were placed under articles to Kenj, I should have my eye on the forbidden ground, and should be able to study it, and master it, and to satisfy myself that it was not neglected, and was being properly conducted. I should be able to look after Ada's interests, and my own interests the same thing. Semicolon and I should peg away at Blackstone, and all those fellows with the most tremendous ardor. I was not by any means so sure of that, and I saw how his hankering after the vague things, yet to come of those long-deferred hopes cast a shade on Ada's face. But I thought it best to encourage him in any project of continuous exertion, and only advised him to be quite sure that his mind was made up now. My dear Minerva, said Richard, I am as steady as you are. I made a mistake. We are all liable to mistakes. I won't do so any more, and I'll become such a lawyer as is not often seen. That is, you know, said Richard, relapsing into doubt, if it really is worthwhile, after all, to make such a disturbance about nothing particular. This led to our saying again, with a great deal of gravity, all that we had said already, and to our coming to much the same conclusion afterwards. But we so strongly advised Richard to be frank and open with Mr. Jarndyce, without a moment's delay, and his disposition was naturally so opposed to concealment, that he sought him out at once, taking us with him, and made a full avowal. Rick, said my guardian, after hearing him attentively, we can retreat with honor, and we will. But we must be careful for our cousin's sake, Rick, for our cousin's sake, that we make no more such mistakes. Therefore, in the matter of the law, we will have a good trial before we decide. We will look before we leap, and take plenty of time about it. Richard's energy was of such an impatient and fitful kind, that he would have liked nothing better than to have gone to Mr. Kenj's office in that hour, and to have entered into articles with him on the spot. Submitting, however, with a good grace to the caution that we had shown to be so necessary, he contented himself with sitting down among us in his lightest spirits and talking, as if his one unvarying purpose in life from childhood had been that one which now held possession of him. My guardian was very kind and cordial with him, but rather grave, enough so to cause Ada, when he had departed, and we were going upstairs to bed, to say, Cousin John, I hope you don't think the worse of Richard? No, my love, said he. Because it was very natural that Richard should be mistaken in such a difficult case. It is not uncommon. No, no, my love, said he. Don't look unhappy. Oh, I am not unhappy, Cousin John, said Ada, smiling cheerfully, with her hand upon his shoulder, where she had put it in bidding him good night. But I should be a little so, if you thought at all the worse of Richard. My dear, said Mr. Jarndyce, I should think the worse of him, only if he were ever in the least unhappy through his means. I should be more disposed to quarrel with myself even then, than with poor Rick, for I brought you together. But, tut, all this is nothing. He has time before him, and the race to run. I think the worse of him? Not I, my loving cousin. And not you, I swear. No, indeed, Cousin John, said Ada, I am sure I could not, I am sure I would not think any ill of Richard, if the whole world did. I could, and I would, think better of him then than at any other time. So quietly and honestly she said it, with her hands upon his shoulders, both hands now, and looking up into his face, like the picture of truth. I think, said my guardian, thoughtfully regarding her, I think it must be somewhere written that the virtues of the mothers shall occasionally be visited on the children, as well as the sins of the father. Good night, my rosebud. Good night, little woman. Pleasant slumbers. Happy dreams. This was the first time I ever saw him follow Ada with his eyes with something of a shadow on their benevolent expression. I well remembered the look with which he had contemplated her, and Richard when she was singing in the firelight. It was but a very little while since he had watched them passing down the room in which the sun was shining, and away into the shade. But his glance was changed, and even the silent look of confidence in me which now followed it once more was not quite so hopeful and untroubled as it had originally been. Ada praised Richard more to me that night than ever she had praised him yet. She went to sleep with a little bracelet he had given her clasped upon her arm. I fancied she was dreaming of him when I kissed her cheek after she had slept an hour and saw how tranquil and happy she looked. For I was so little inclined to sleep myself that night that I sat up working. It would not be worth mentioning for its own sake, but I was wakeful and rather low-spirited. I don't know why. At least I don't think I know why. At least, perhaps I do, but I don't think it matters. At any rate, I made up my mind to be so dreadfully industrious that I would leave myself not a moment's leisure to be low-spirited. For I naturally said, "Esther, you to be low-spirited. You." And it really was time to say so, for I really did see myself in the glass, almost crying. As if you had anything to make you unhappy, instead of everything to make you happy, you ungrateful heart. Said one. If I could have made myself go to sleep, I would have done it directly, but not being able to do that, I took out of my basket some ornamental work for our house, I mean Bleak House, that I was busy with at that time, and sat down to it with great determination. It was necessary to count all the stitches in that work, and I resolved to go on with it until I couldn't keep my eyes open, and then to go to bed. I soon found myself very busy. But I had left some silk downstairs in a work table drawer in the temporary growlery, and coming to a stop for want of it, I took my candle, and went softly down to get it. To my great surprise, on going in I found my guardian still there, and sitting looking at the ashes. He was lost in thought, his book lay unheeded by his side. His silvered iron-gray hair was scattered confusedly upon his forehead, as though his hand had been wandering among it, while his thoughts were elsewhere, and his face looked worn. Almost frightened by coming upon him so unexpectedly, I stood still for a moment, and should have retired without speaking had he not, in again passing his hand abstractedly through his hair, seen me and started. "Esther," I told him what I had come for. "At work so late, my dear?" "I am working late tonight," said I, "because I couldn't sleep, and wished to tire myself." "But, dear guardian, you are late too, and look weary. You have no trouble, I hope, to keep you waking?" "None, little woman, that you would readily understand," said he. He spoke in a regretful tone so new to me, that I inwardly repeated, as if that would help me to his meaning, that I could readily understand. "Remain a moment, Esther," said he, "you were in my thoughts." "I hope I was not the trouble, guardian?" He slightly waved his hand, and fell into his usual manner. The change was so remarkable, and he appeared to make it by dint of so much self-command, that I found myself again inwardly repeating, "None that I could understand." "Little woman," said my guardian, "I was thinking, that is, I have been thinking, since I have been sitting here, that you ought to know of your own history all I know. It is very little. Next to nothing." "Dear guardian," I replied, "when you spoke to me before on that subject, but since then," he gravely interposed, anticipating what I meant to say, "I have reflected that your having anything to ask me, and my having anything to tell you, are different considerations, Esther. It is perhaps my duty to impart to you the little I know." "If you think so, guardian, it is right." "I think so," he returned very gently, and kindly, and very distinctly. "My dear, I think so now. If any real disadvantage can attach to your position in the mind of any man or woman worth a thought, it is right that you at least of all the world should not magnify it to yourself by having vague impressions of its nature." I sat down and said after a little effort, to be as calm as I ought to be, "One of my earliest remembrances, guardian, is of these words. Your mother, Esther, is your disgrace, and you were hers. The time will come, and soon enough, when you will understand this better, and will feel it too, as no one save a woman can. I had covered my face with my hands in repeating the words, but I took them away now with a better kind of shame, I hope, and told him that to him, I owed the blessing that I had from my childhood to that hour never, never, never felt it. He put up his hand, as if to stop me. I well knew that he was never to be thanked, and said no more. 9 years, my dear, he said after thinking for a little while, have passed since I received a letter from a lady living in seclusion, written with a stern passion and power that rendered it unlike all other letters I have ever read. It was written to me as it told me in so many words, perhaps because it was the writer's idiosyncrasy to put that trust in me, perhaps because it was mine to justify it. It told me of a child, an orphan girl then 12 years old, in some such cruel words as those which live in your remembrance. It told me that the writer had bred her in secrecy from her birth, had blotted out all trace of her existence, and that if the writer were to die before the child became a woman, she would be left entirely friendless, nameless, and unknown. It asked me to consider if I would, in that case, finish what the writer had begun. I listened in silence and looked attentively at him. Your early recollection, my dear, will supply the gloomy medium through which all this was seen and expressed by the writer, and the distorted religion which clouded her mind with impressions of the need there was for the child to expiate an offense of which she was quite innocent. I felt concerned for the little creature in her darkened life, and replied to the letter. I took his hand and kissed it. It laid the injunction on me that I should never propose to see the writer, who had long been estranged from all intercourse with the world, but who would see a confidential agent if I would appoint one. I accredited Mr. Kench. The lady said, of her own accord, and not of his seeking, that her name was an assumed one. That she was, if there were any ties of blood in such a case, the child's aunt. That more than this, she would never, and he was well persuaded of the steadfastness of her resolution, for any human consideration disclose. My dear, I have told you all. I held his hand for a little while in mine. I saw my ward oftener than she saw me, he added, cheerily making light of it, and I always knew she was beloved, useful, and happy. She repays me 20,000-fold, and 20 more to that, every hour in every day. And oftener still, said I, she blesses the guardian who is a father to her. At the word father, I saw his former trouble come into his face. He subdued it as before, and it was gone in an instant, but it had been there, and it had come so swiftly upon my words, that I felt as if they had given him a shock. I again inwardly repeated, wondering, that I could readily understand. None that I could readily understand. No, it was true. I did not understand it. Not for many and many a day. Take a fatherly good night, my dear, said he, kissing me on the forehead, and so to rest. These are late hours for working and thinking. You do that for all of us, all day long, little housekeeper. I neither worked nor thought any more that night. I opened my grateful heart to heaven in thankfulness for its providence to me, and its care of me, and fell asleep. We had a visitor next day. Mr. Allan Woodcourt came. He came to take leave of us. He had settled to do so beforehand. He was going to China, and to India as a surgeon on board ship. He was to be away a long, long time. I believe at least I know that he was not rich. All his widowed mother could spare had been spent in qualifying him for his profession. It was not lucrative to a young practitioner with very little influence in London, and although he was, night and day, at the service of numbers of poor people and did wonders of gentleness and skill for them, he gained very little by it in money. He was 7 years older than one. Not that I need mention it, for it hardly seems to belong to anything. I think I mean, he told us that he had been in practice 3 or 4 years and that, if he could have hoped to contend through 3 or 4 more, he would not have made the voyage on which he was bound. But he had no fortune or private means, and so he was going away. He had been to see us several times altogether. We thought it a pity he should go away, because he was distinguished in his art among those who knew it best, and some of the greatest men belonging to it had a high opinion of him. When he came to bid us goodbye, he brought his mother with him for the first time. She was a pretty old lady, with bright black eyes, but she seemed proud. She came from Wales and had had, a long time ago, an eminent person for an ancestor, of the name of Morgan ap Carrig of some place, that sounded like Imlet, who was the most illustrious person that ever was known, and all of whose relations were a sort of royal family. He appeared to have passed his life in always getting up in 2 mountains and fighting somebody, and a bard whose name sounded like Crumlinwoolin were had sung his praises in a piece which was called, as nearly as I could catch it, Milinwillinwood. Mrs. Woodcourt, after expatiating to us on the fame of her great kinsman, said that no doubt, wherever her son Alan went he would remember his pedigree, and would on no account form an alliance below it. She told him that there were many handsome English ladies in India who went out on speculation, and that there were some to be picked up with property, but that neither charms nor wealth would suffice for the descendant from such a line without birth, which must ever be the first consideration. She talked so much about birth, that for a moment I half fancied, and with pain, but what an idle fancy to suppose, that she could think, or care what mine was. Mr. Woodcourt seemed a little distressed by her prolixity, but he... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.